Support for this program is made possible in part by USI Outreach and Engagement, where USI is partnering with 23 counties along I-69, collaborating on economic development. More information at usi.edu/community.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Thank you for joining us today. Well, we're focusing on last week's elections, veterans, and Evansville's home front during the Second World War. Later in the program, we'll hear my full interview with James McLeod, author of the new book, Evansville in World War II. We'll also hear the sounds of a Veterans Day ceremony held this week at Evansville's Oak Hill Cemetery. But first, joining me is Matt Hanke, the Assistant Professor of Political Science at USI. He's also the director of the Masters of Public Administration program at USI. Matt, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
And also John Martin of the Evansville Courier and Press, longtime reporter. John, we appreciate you coming in.
Always a pleasure, John.
All right. Well, let's talk about last week's election here. Here in Evansville, Mayor Lloyd Winicky won re-election by an almost 2-1 margin over Democratic State Representative Gail Reakin. Now, going into it, we knew that Winicky had a big lead in fundraising, but let's start with you, John. Were you surprised by the size of the victory?
I was. I felt going in, John, that Mayor Winicky would get in the neighborhood of 54-58%. 62% was a little more than I anticipated, but he had a lot working in his favor. He really did. You mentioned the fundraising. Impossible to overstate how important that is. To be able to get your message out. He's additionally, he's very well liked, very personally popular. He had some accomplishments in office. I think the fact that he broke ground on the downtown medical school maybe, 10 days or so before the election.
Right.
The timing was pretty good on that, I'd say. The downtown hotel is underway. I think regardless of your feeling about how that came about, most people, I think, view that as a good thing for Evansville. He had a lot working in his favor.
Yes, indeed. Matt, how did you see the election? Were you surprised that Mayor Winicky won by such a large margin?
A little bit, just because Evansville has a lot of registered Democrats. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you see situations like this where when Democrats stay at home, Republicans often get elected. And he had the advantage of having a second straight election campaign where he was facing an opponent that was a part of a fractured coalition. The Democratic right. Party wasn't unified in 2011 with Rick Davis and wasn't unified or didn't show that much unity, at least going to the polls in 2015. She ran a negative campaign and Mayor Winicky resisted it. And things that John had said of just staying positive, running on your record, doing a good campaign, that resulted in that victory. And a lot of the large margin has a lot to do with Democratic supporters staying at home.
Yes. Now, John, you've been covering city government for quite a while here in Evansville. Does it strike you that the Democrats are rather splintered these days?
I think that's even understating it. I think they're very splintered. The hope was, if you go back to a year ago at the holidays when Representative Reakin got in, I think the real hope among Democrats was that she would be a unifying force, that she would bring all the family together, so to speak, and it just never materialized. And there's not any one reason for that. There's a lot of personality rifts among the elected Democrats in Evansville. Plus, to be perfectly honest, I think Mayor Winicky deserves some credit for that. He courted and received union support. He was pretty popular for a Republican candidate in the African-American community here in Evansville. He took a lot of pride in that. Mm-hmm. A lot of factors, and it just never took off for Gail Reakin. She never found her voice. My opinion, I think it's shared by others, is that she made a couple of missteps during the campaign. I don't think it was wise for her to call a news conference and refer to the downtown hotel, regardless of you thought about what you thought about the process, mm-hmm. but to call it a concern that it would be a blight on the downtown.
Exactly.
I don't think
You're
that
right.
was a wise thing at all to
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Right.
Some of the problems she inherited, being able to unite the party, that was a tall order. Some other problems that she had were of her own making, I felt.
Sure. And, of course, another big issue that she was raising throughout the campaign, possibly with some help from some of the Democrats on the city council, was the city finances. Apparently that was an issue that just didn't gain traction, Matt?
It didn't gain traction. I think Winicky and his supporters were very effective in showing that you, when you have to move money around various accounts, that it's more seamless and easy than just taking one pot that's dedicated versus the other. It wasn't an argument that held on. Reakin did have a chance to hit the mayor on issues with respect to dealing with the hotel project, and that there was money that was spent and wasted, if you will, on the first phase of the project. But as John said, calling it a blight, that whole argument was dead. And number two, she's trying to make an argument with respect to transparency, and it didn't hold because the voters and the public didn't feel that what they're seeing with the city council was not transparent.
Right.
The city's really been hit hard, John, as you know, by property tax caps, not being able to increase the property tax rate.
Right, as all communities across the state have faced that problem, haven't
they? Right. I paid my tax bill at the Civic Center last week, and every time I've done that lately, I've observed that it doesn't change a whole lot from year to year, which is great for me as a taxpayer, but for the local government, it makes it difficult because the cost of business inevitably goes up. And Representative Reakin argued that the city needs to cut spending further. Mayor Winicky, as Matt said, pushed back pretty effectively at that. In the new term, they are going to have to look at these tough issues a little closer. Maybe with a different city council, there might be some more cooperation on that front. We'll have to see.
Yeah, well, let's get into that a little bit, because this election, plus the fact that some city council members didn't seek re-election, changed the makeup of the council. It trims the Democratic majority to 5-4 now. And two of those Democrats have backed the Republican mayor on many issues. John, you've been covering the city council for a number of years now. Will Mayor Winicky be able to just pretty much push through anything he wants?
That's the way it looks today, John. He's got, as you said, it's a 5-4 majority, although that's a little bit deceiving because at least two of those Democrats, Missy Mosby and Jonathan Weaver, were largely sympathetic toward him during this last term, much more so than their colleagues who are not there any longer. Mm-hmm. You've got four Republicans on there now as opposed to one before. They figure, we'll have to wait and see, but they figure to be supportive of the mayor. So he's got a pretty good handle on things, I'd say. It'll be interesting to see in this new term if a loyal opposition faction emerges on the council.
Right.
One would think that would fall to Dan Adams and Connie Robinson, who are two of the Democrat holdovers from the last term, who butted heads with the mayor at times. Right. But there's only two of them now, whereas before there were four or five of the people who fit that description.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, let's get your take on that. How will these changes affect city policy starting next year?
I think what you saw with the council with an 8-1 makeup before the election, you saw a lot of obstruction for the sake of obstruction. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of Democrats who were working hard to pass legislation or do things so as to put the mayor on the defensive or to even embarrass him. This eliminates that possibility. One thing with the hotel project, it would have been an interesting decision if the mayor had waited on the hotel financing until he got a new council that was more sympathetic and reintroduced the proposal. I absolutely understand why we pushed through it. It's a good thing to demonstrate during elections. But you're not going to see a lot of this. I don't think you're going to see as dirty of political machinations and maneuvers that you saw where we're going to cut things at the 11th hour just to make the mayor look bad.
Although I would argue that the 11th hour cuts that the Democrats made actually boomeranged and actually helped Winicky.
That's true.
They made the Democrats look like the bad guys.
Yeah, and that could have even affected the vote, because even if some wanted to vote for Reakin or other people on the city council, it did backfire.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the other mayoral candidate here for just a bit. And I don't mean to laugh, but Steve Wozniak, the independent mayoral candidate, he picked up 4% of the vote in the Evansville city election. Anybody surprised by that? Did that seem about what you were expecting, John?
Didn't really know what to expect. I didn't figure he'd get very much. 4% might be a little more than I would have anticipated. He got some good exposure on the debate. Mm-hmm. He got equal time on the WNIN debate, which you moderated. Perhaps that helped him a little bit. I would say unofficial returns, he got about 800 votes, and for a campaign fund that had about $50 in it, maybe that's a pretty good yield.
Right.
And oftentimes, when you have a third party, sometimes people look at a third party and maybe they're choosing because it's the lesser of three evils, if you will. Mm-hmm. And
there's, or sometimes a protest
or
vote.
Or sometimes a protest vote. And there may have been some folks who voted for Wozniak because they see Winicky as not being transparent. And then they were disappointed and dissatisfied with the way Rieken's running her campaign. 4%, I expected a little bit more just because of that reality of folks coming. I mean, there's plenty of things you could have identified with what Winicky did and the mistakes he made, and identify the bad campaign Rieken ran. But at the same time, all things being equal, it's a reasonable result.
Well, before we move on, were Wozniak's proposals, Matt, for making the city better connected through fiber technology and ramping up the use of industrial hemp, did that resonate with anyone? And is it something that will be a serious thing in the future?
Having connected with fiber cables and having that connectivity, that's a very important point he made. And perhaps maybe the conversation can be broadened. These are things we're going to be needing to think about. Mm-hmm. Evansville is going to have to position itself in the future to be looking at the trends that exist, not only in the city and the region, but in the state, in the nation, and in the globe, if Evansville wants to position itself and compete. And it's not a far-fetched idea to be thinking that way. I'm sure the other candidates didn't think of it much.
And then, John, what about this idea of industrial hemp being a boon, for the future?
A little bit of a Hail Mary pass. You're talking about tearing down the Civic Center. I guess that's what he was talking about.
Yeah, he proposed building at least some sort of a civic building, out of hemp.
Yeah, a little bit of a Hail Mary pass there, I'd say.
Well, let's also, before we move on to other elections, the voter turnout looked to be something in the neighborhood of 20%. Here in Evansville, but I'm guessing that number might be a little skewed. That's the impression I get, John.
It's difficult to keep voter registration rolls current for obvious reasons. People die, they move, and so on. The voter turnout percentage for me is I don't know how much that statistic is really to be trusted. The number of votes cast, though, it was disappointing. If you look at years past here in Evansville city election cycles, there have been 30,000 plus counted. Even when Jonathan Weinzapfel won his first term, when he beat Russ Lloyd Jr., that was 03, I believe. Mm-hmm. There was well over 30,000 cast. Here you're looking at maybe 20, 21,000.
Yeah, 20,084, yeah.
It's a little bit disappointing. And from our standpoint in the press, we spent an awful lot of time writing about the issues, sending Q&A to candidates. So a little discouraging, but I would say, and I'd be curious, Matt, as a political scientist, maybe you have thoughts on this too. Sometimes I almost wonder if we get too caught up in the quantity of voters rather than the quality of voters. I don't think you want people necessarily to go out and vote if they haven't followed it, if they don't have any idea what's going on. You want quality and quantity of voters.
Yeah, because the currency for any politician is votes. That's what it's counted. It's where money counts, but it's votes. And you obviously have to have another majority, but 20% is disappointing. And we have a system where we provide little incentive for people to vote, even though we put it upon themselves that this is your civic duty, this is what you're going to do, and there's reasons why people are motivated to vote. Sometimes the non-voting is itself a conscious decision. Making that the non-decision is very important, but it misses the big picture in that by staying home, you're affecting the outcome of an election in a different way. Democrats are dissatisfied with their Democratic candidate. Right. They're going to have Republicans or somebody other than a Democrat get elected. And it's the opposite of what they always wanted or intended.
Well, on John's point of an informed electorate, what can we do to get more people engaged in local, state, national elections?
I think it's doing that by using more social media, using more outlets that gets the word out. Sometimes we have this system where when it comes to voting, we have it where maybe on a day like Tuesday is probably not the best day to vote. Maybe mm-hmm. we ought to be thinking of other days.
Like on a weekend or something?
On a weekend. We have an intentionally flawed setup voting system where the model is flawed. We're basing it on Tuesday because it's 160 years old. If you figure out another day,
you can vote early, though.
You can vote early, and that's been added, but mm-hmm. maybe that's another angle of enticing more early voting. But technology is oftentimes used as a way of getting your message out, not so much as a way to entice people to go to the polls, because some people may, you know, they have the right to vote, but then oftentimes they don't actualize the right to vote.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's switch to the Kentucky side of the river for a moment. The gubernatorial race over there surprised quite a few people. Let's go back to you, Matt. How did Republican businessman Matt Bevin beat Democrat Jack Conway, especially when other Democrats on the Kentucky ballot won?
Well, he won by over 8 points, and that was surprising. Conway always had in the polls in August, September, and October had a 5-point lead, which mm-hmm. you always need to go twice the margin of error in order to feel like you have a comfortable lead in his favor. So coming down to Election Day, it was possible, but one of the things Bevin did was maintain a personal connection to voters. He went out there and pressed the flesh. He introduced himself. He was accessible. Jack Conway did a lot of fundraising, and if he interacted, he often interacted with donors and other politicians. That had an effect, and it also affected others on the Democratic ticket as well. State Auditor Adam Edlin lost his race, and mm-hmm. Adam is often seen. I've personally met Adam. He's one of the most naturally gifted politicians of our generation. Mm. And he had an ability he couldn't win, and others down ticket couldn't win as well. Andy Beshear was elected Attorney General in large part because of the support from his father. And Allison Lundgren Grimes had a little more name recognition.
Right.
But Conway just did not have a passionate campaign. And this is, we've been talking earlier about getting people to vote. I would also add that a lot of people want to have an emotional connection. Doesn't necessarily seem rational, but people want to have that emotional connection.
So it's more than just issues. Oh, I agree with this person on that.
They want to have that passion and feel that connection. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's an indictment of our generation or not. And I don't know if that should be the sole reason one should vote for a candidate. But he didn't entice. He did not rile up the base. He did not get them excited about coming out and voting for them. And Bevin, in a way, excited a little bit more through his approach. Bevin also had... a lot of the pundits in Kentucky were talking about he did his campaign his way. Uh-huh. He really didn't have a lot of connection to the Kentucky Republican Party, and he did it in a way, sort of an outsider, and people responded to that mentality, and especially that's just what they're seeing. Yeah,
right, that's just what I was going to say. He was an outsider in a time when outsiders are leading the Republican presidential campaign at this point.
I was going to ask Matt, too, yeah. Do you feel that the Bevin victory will embolden the more conservative Republican presidential candidates, a Cruz, for example, to make him feel, and supporters of him feel like he's, hey, I've really got a shot at this thing?
I think it's going to embolden Cruz in the fact that they are more aligned with the Tea Party. I think Trump and Carson, on the other hand, are going to feel energized mm-hmm. because they're non-politicians who are at the top of the polls. Bevin's a non-politician. And people have responded to that mm-hmm. of seeing people who have not had that political experience. But there's always this expectation at the end of the day in the back of voters' minds to have some kind of experience when you get to the table. So right. In terms of the presidential election, that obviously will play itself out. Bevin is putting together a team, and he's, you know, one thing he has to keep in mind, he's running an organization of 35,000 employees
right.
and having to fill positions. And that gets lost sometimes on politicians that are driven ideologically. You know, yeah. You're still running an organization, especially if you're running for an executive position.
Right. Okay, well, in the couple of minutes we have left, let's look to next year a little bit, next year's elections. John, before we went on the air, we were talking a bit about that. There will be a lot of candidates on the Indiana ballot, right? Vandenberg County.
Sure, we're talking about races at the county level. You're talking about in Vandenberg County, two of the three county commissioner positions are going to be on the ballot. We've already got a race shaping up there. Steve Melcher, the only Democrat of the three county commissioners, is running for re-election. Mm-hmm. Cheryl Musgrave, a Republican, a former office holder here, is right. including a former county commissioner, is interested in that seat, so that sets up as a mm-hmm. race. Joe Kiefer, the other county commissioner whose seat is up, Not sure if Joe is going to run again. I haven't asked him, but his seat is up. Then you have three county council positions and a series of other county elected positions that aren't all that sexy or exciting. County clerk, county assessor, mm-hmm. county treasurer.
But also you've got the entire state legislature and the governor's race.
The entire state legislature, all House and Senate this time, mm-hmm. and President of the United States, the Senate seat in Indiana, which is now held by Dan Coats, mm-hmm. who is not running.
Right.
The House of Representatives seat. So a lot going on, and governor of Indiana.
Of course, of course. And with those big races, Matt, I assume we can expect quite a bit larger voter turnout this time.
Mm-hmm. We'll definitely see higher than 20% here in Evansville or over 30% in the Kentucky gubernatorial election. But in 2008 and 2012, we all remember the 2008 election as being transformative. That was only about mm-hmm. a 63-64% turnout. So we'll definitely see it high with a lot of those. I'll add that in the House elections, U.S. House of Representative elections, you only see a handful of contested elections among all 435, mm-hmm. and that's the result of gerrymandering and other right. things. So we'll probably can predict a safe Republican majority in the House. The Senate, if I recall, of 24, I think they have 24 of the 34 seats Republicans try to retain, even though there's mm-hmm. going to be...
I know there's been some talk that Democrats might have a chance to take back the Senate.
They would have to contest certainly a lot of Republican seats. And a lot of those are the toss-ups usually come for those that are retired or decide not to seek another term. Mm-hmm. So it's entirely possible. Yeah. And that'll be something that more we'll keep an eye on at the Senate, but the House is more of a fait accompli even now.
Right. All right. Well, we will be watching, and we certainly appreciate both of you coming in today. We've been listening to Matt Hanke. He's an assistant professor of political science at USI, also the director of the Master of Public Administration program at USI. Also joining us today, John Martin, longtime reporter of the Evansville Courier and Press. Again, we thank you both for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
All appreciate right. it. Thank you.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. We'll take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. Trending today, the recent city election. Also now coming up next, Professor James McLeod from the University of Evansville has a new book out on Evansville in World War II. And then John Gibson went to a Veterans Day ceremony this week, and we'll have a special remembrance for our veterans later on in the hour. So stay tuned.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. An Evansville author has published a new book that's getting a lot of attention, Evansville in World War II. I sat down this week with James McLeod, who started our conversation with an unusual observation.
I'm very proud to say that I know more about Evansville and World War II than any living Scotsman. So it's not something I thought I would be able to say, but I can say it with great pride now.
Well, yes, you are a Scottish native, transplanted to Indiana. You teach at the University of Evansville, and a lot of folks might know you from your editorial cartoons for the Courier and Press. But tell us, what fuels your fascination with World War II?
Well, I grew up in the 70s and 80s. My parents were both involved with World War II. My father was in the British Merchant Navy on the North Atlantic convoys. So, you know, as a kid, you're growing up with an interest in the war. The end of our street, in fact, had been bombed during the war by the German Air Force. And then when I became a professor and started teaching courses on the war, I realized pretty quickly that talking about battles and soldiers doesn't really tell the full story, and that a key part of the story is the people who make the things with which soldiers fight. And that's where I think you become interested in places like Evansville.
Sure, sure. Well, your book, Evansville in World War II, is divided into chapters about the city's tremendous wartime effort, including how it came to be that this city produced so many ships, airplanes, and ammunition. How did Evansville win so many of those Pentagon contracts?
Well, it's a great question. I think a very important question, because sometimes we make the assumption that because something happened, it was always meant to happen. And in fact, the reality is that when in 1941, when the country was gearing up for what they thought was an impending war, mm-hmm. and war production was ramping up across the country, cities that didn't have a tradition of building military materials were in severe danger of being left out.
Right.
And a city like Evansville could easily have been a ghost town instead of a boom town. But what I discovered, and I think is really interesting, is that it took a working coalition of organized labor, business, and political officials to work together and lobby and use their contacts and convince the powers that be in Washington that Evansville needed to be given special treatment, effectively.
And you might call those some strange bedfellows there.
Oh,
too, right?
Very much so. I mean, there's stories of these guys actually arguing in meetings and so on. I mean, labor and business had not had an easy relationship in Evansville.
Yeah.
And Evansville politics, of course, is notorious for its cantankerous nature. But I think they realized that the stakes were so high that they had to work together to get this done.
Yeah. And of course, once Pearl Harbor happened, the speed in which the city was transformed is truly amazing.
It really is. I think the speed might be the single most amazing thing about the whole story. If you think that Pearl Harbor happened on the 7th of December, 1941, by February and March of 42, they had already announced that the shipyard and Republic Aviation were coming to Evansville. And by the summer of 42, both of these plants were already producing material.
Yeah.
So, you know, you go from nothing being there at all to actually producing ships and planes just within a matter of months.
And, of course, that meant an enormous influx of workers into the Evansville area. I believe, didn't our population reach something like 150,000?
Yeah, the working population, the industrial population, more than tripled from 18,000 to over 60,000. Hmm. And, of course, a lot of these people bring in with them families and you know, children, spouses, and so on. And, you know, extreme pressure on housing and accommodation. You know, where are these people going to eat? How are you going to move them around the city? And so what you see is the city making a really concerted effort to provide accommodation for all of these thousands of people who moved in.
Yeah, so how was it addressed, the housing issue, especially because you've got to find, you know, roofs to put these people under?
Absolutely. You know, initially it's fairly piecemeal, you know, a little bit of building here and there. And then over the course of the war, you see at least six major federal housing projects being erected in the city,
mm-hmm.
One of which was designated specifically for African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the great irony of it is that there's constant repetition of the word temporary. These are all going to be temporary places.
But some of these places still stay.
They sure do. Many of our listeners will be familiar with Fulton Square and Diamond Villa.
Right.
They were brought here during the war. They were going to be temporary. As soon as we don't need them, they're going to be taken away. And yet they're still there and still flourishing.
Well, your book is divided into several chapters, you know, various issues and situations here in Evansville. And it's been widely discussed about how many women joined the workforce during the war effort across the U.S., but a lot of women obviously mobilized here in Evansville as well.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think you could call it really social transformation. Women working in positions that they would never have had before. Women having positions of authority that they would never have had before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our familiar image of the war women, I suppose, is Rosie the Riveter.
Right.
You know, yes, there were riveters, many of them up at Republic Aviation working on the P-47 Thunderbolts. And no riveters at the shipyard because there were no rivets.
Right.
The ships were welded together, and women played a really important role there. Many, many women welders working at the shipyard, and I think in many other places at Evansville Ordnance and Cervelle and all these other places, women joined the workforce in large numbers.
And I believe you've got a photograph in the book of Evelyn Cox, who I believe, was she the first woman to work at the shipyard?
Evelyn Cox was, I think, what they say is the first woman to be a three-position welder. Hmm. And there's just a marvelous, iconic photograph of her, and she's great because she's the one who says that she really preferred working as a welder to doing the regular woman's work at home, you know, which I think is a powerful reminder to us always of how hard a woman's work is. And for these women, it was just, I think, a glimpse of a different world, right? That here you could work outside the home and do things that maybe you never imagined possible.
And you touched on this a bit. Another part of your book focuses on race during the war. Here in Evansville, many African Americans worked alongside their white counterparts. But sadly, as you put it in the book, even a cataclysm the size of World War II couldn't change attitudes toward race.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that for me, that was one of the great ironies of this research is that 405,000 Americans die fighting in a war supposedly in the name of equality and justice and democracy. Mm-hmm. And yet our society here at home, at least in places and in parts, was anything but. And for a lot of these African-Americans, the war, I think, was something that stimulated the realization that this was a hypocrisy and an irony that had to be dealt with, and perhaps, at least in part, fueled the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s.
Perhaps the seeds for both African-American movement and also the women's movement can be found here, right?
Absolutely, because I think for a lot of women, what they found at the end of the war is that they had to go back to business as usual. Mm-hmm. But the experiences of being here and being in these positions during the war showed them a world that they didn't know existed and that they wanted to campaign for after the war.
Well, another societal issue during World War II that you don't hear a lot about, but you certainly cover in your book, is prostitution. Just how rampant was it here in Evansville?
Well, it was. There were times when I was blushing as I was doing this research. It really surprised me. Probably shouldn't have, but it really did. To see front page stories in the Courier and the press talking about the red light district downtown, a designated part of the downtown area where there were between 20 and 30 establishments providing prostitution.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. And what then happened was when Camp Breckinridge, Kentucky, and various other military bases opened up around here, the military pushed to close down the red light district. And there was pushback here in the city, and I think it's a very practical pushback that if you have a designated red light district, at least you know where it's happening. It can be policed, it can be monitored, and it can be regulated. If you close down the red light district, which is what happened, prostitution doesn't go away. Right. It just scatters through the city, and you see documents from the federal government where they actually detail all the places in Evansville where soldiers encountered prostitutes. And there's still, you know, 20 or 30 places where it's happening. Right, right. We just didn't know where they were.
And why was the military so concerned about that?
Well, I don't think it's a puritanical thing or a moral thing particularly. It's a very practical thing that there was a concern that soldiers who encountered prostitutes would contract sexually transmitted infections. And a soldier with an STI is not an effective soldier anymore. Yeah. And I think it's purely that practical matter of keeping our soldiers healthy that motivated that.
Well, you also have a chapter in the book regarding those who didn't make it home alive. 459 Evansville residents lost their lives in the war, and quite a few people died in war-related jobs here in Evansville, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, we tend to think about war casualties as being people who are killed on the battlefront, and we tend to think of the home front as being relatively safe, and really it was anything but. And millions and millions of Americans were injured and thousands killed in accidents across the country in industry. And here in Evansville, I looked specifically at the shipyard, but you know, there were serious accidents at the shipyard every day. Yeah. At least 10 men were killed in the shipyard, and then others were killed around the outside of it. So, you know, I think it's easy to forget. We talk about the speed with which these places were thrown together. You know, shipyards are always dangerous places, and when you have so many people, remember that at its peak of employment, the shipyard had 18,000 people working there. Yeah. You know, it's almost impossible to do that without some people getting hurt.
Now, there's not much of the shipyard that remains here in Evansville. It's pretty much well, you know, just wiped away off of Ohio Street there. There is a couple of things that you can still see, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of folks are really surprised to know that where Mead Johnson is today, there was once a 45-acre shipyard mm-hmm. churning out vital ships for the war effort. There's a small marker in their parking lot. And if you look hard enough, you can see little pieces of a couple of the piers still poke out into the river. And then there's one crane in the parking lot of a business just on the riverside there. But as you drive around the city and look at many of the buildings where these things took place, many of these industrial buildings are still there, but they've been repurposed, and you can't see there even the names of the companies. And I think it's really quite sad because it's easy for us to forget what happened here.
I live close to the Mead Johnson area, and I often see that rusty old crane mm-hmm. sitting there off of Broadway, I believe it is there. And perhaps someday that could become some sort of a monument. I guess it's sort of a monument as it stands.
It's almost an invisible monument. I mean, it's in a parking lot, and you get really funny looks if you show up there. But I think maybe in the future we're confident that someday the LST, and by the way, it's wonderful that we have an LST here in town. You know, maybe when the casino moves, if the LST moves to that spot, wouldn't it be great to have that crane there as well? You know, so close, but, you know, very easy distance of where the shipyard actually was. Mm-hmm. And it would remind you not just of the importance of these ships, which some historians say were the single most important ship used in amphibious assaults, both in the Pacific and Europe. But that these ships were built here using equipment like that crane.
And as I understand it, the LSTs and the P-47s that were all built here in Evansville had pretty good safety records, right?
Oh, yeah. We did a great job here. They say that the P-47 Thunderbolt was one of the safest planes to fly. The old joke was that if you wanted to get a nice-looking girl, you should fly a Mustang. But if you wanted to come home to her, you should fly a P-47 Thunderbolt. And then with the Evansville LSTs, only 10 of them were lost during the war. And the local people here are very proud to say that all 10 were as a result of enemy action. They weren't lost because of any problem with their manufacture.
Right. Well, what surprised you most in researching this book?
Well, you right at the beginning mentioned speed. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the speed that all this took place was the first thing that surprised me. And the second was scale. You know, we tend to focus on just the shipyard and Republic Aviation. But, you know, you have to also think about the Evansville Ordnance Plant producing billions of rounds of ammunition.
And that was the Chrysler plant.
It was mostly in the Chrysler plant and also in the Sunbeam plant just mm-hmm. down the road on Maxwell. Uh-huh. And dozens of other plants around the city, some of which were really large plants, you know, International Steel and Cervell, which were all contributing to this massive set of moving parts right. that helped win the war for the Allies.
Well, anything else to add that we haven't touched on here?
I think just the last thing I would say is to emphasize that point that without the stuff being made here, which was part of this enormous American production effort, I don't think there's any way the Allies could have won the war. So I think that the people of Evansville can quite proudly say that they played an important part in winning the most important war in human history.
That is James Lachlan McLeod. James, we certainly appreciate you joining us here today. The book is Evansville in World War II. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I appreciate it very much.
And by the way, James McLeod is also working on a book now about legendary Evansville cartoonist Carl K. Kinect. Well, coming up, we'll visit Oak Hill Cemetery for a regional Veterans Day ceremony. We hope you'll stay with us.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. That was University of Evansville history professor James McLeod talking about his book on Evansville and World War II. Up next, John takes us to a Veterans Day ceremony here in Evansville this past week. Stay tuned.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. I'm John Gibson. Good to have you along. Well, up next, we listen in to a regional Veterans Day ceremony that was held this week at Oak Hill Cemetery in Evansville. Larry Acker emceed the event. He heads up the Vandenberg County Veterans Council and oversees the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Coliseum in downtown Evansville. Mayor Lloyd Winicky announced the winner of this year's Veteran of the Year. The keynote speaker was Army Sergeant Major Jerry Blake, and the ceremony concluded with a gun salute and taps. But first, Acker told the gathering that the Evansville Coliseum's 100th anniversary is coming up in April.
Some people consider the Coliseum a building. It's 66,000 square feet of honor. The stones are those of the dead and those who gave their lives for this country. The martyr is their blood that was shed for this country. And the foundation that it sits on is the foundation of this nation. And the day we forget that, then we are a sad nation. And that's about all you need to hear out of me today. I'd ask the Honorable Lloyd Winicky, Mayor of Evansville, to please come forward.
Well, good afternoon. It's my pleasure to be here today to carry on the tradition of presenting the Veteran of the Year. I'd also like to acknowledge members of the City Council here today, Missy Mosby and Jonathan Weaver, always great supporters of our city and supporters of veterans. First, before I get into the Veteran of the Year, let me, on behalf of the citizens of Evansville, thank all the veterans for the service and the sacrifice that you and your families have made on behalf of our country and our city. We are very grateful, so thank you. Well, our Veteran of the Year attended Bossie High School and North High School. He joined the U.S. Marine Corps in 1964. He did his basic training in Parris Island, moved on to Camp Lejeune for his advanced infantry training. He was deployed to Vietnam in May of 1965 with K Company 3rd Battalion 3rd Marine Division. It was there that he was injured during combat and was awarded the Purple Heart Medal. After spending 8.5 months recovering at Great Lakes Naval Hospital, our Veteran of the Year was stationed at Camp Pendleton. He was discharged from the Marine Corps in 1970 and was a member of the Indiana National Guard for several years. His military awards include the Purple Heart, the Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal, the National Defense Service Medal, the Vietnam Service Medal, the Vietnam Campaign Medal, Good Conduct Medal, and the Combat Action Medal Ribbon. He's been a lifetime member of the VFW Post 1114, charter member of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, Chapter 726, serving two terms as commander, served as senior vice commander of the Vandenberg Veterans Council in 2015, a lifetime member of the Disabled Americans Veteran Chapter 7, is also a member, a volunteer at the VA clinic for the past 3 years. Family is very important to our Veteran of the Year. He's been married to his wife since 1997. They have two sons. And they have 8 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming and honoring the Veteran of the Year, Larry Lupman.
This was not expected. I'd like to thank the council for this award and all the veterans for being here. I wish I had a speech prepared, but I do appreciate it. I thank all the veterans here, all the veterans that came before us. Their service will never be forgotten, and I'm speechless. I just don't know what to say. But thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
at this time is an honor. Of course, I've never met too many in my life. And my military service, I probably made the most important person I ever saw in my life was a captain and my first sergeant. And that's how I got back here, because he knew what he was doing, and thank God for that. But this time, I'd like, it is my extreme pleasure, and I can't even begin to write all the things this gentleman has done in his lifetime, so I'm not even going to attempt to that. But I would like to ask for our main address will be by Sergeant Major Jerry Blake, United States Army, retired.
Thanks for that kind introduction, Mark. Mayor Winicky, congratulations on your re-elections. Councilman Mosley, Councilman Weaver. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow veterans, it really is a great pleasure for me to be here today. When Mark asked me to come up and say a few words and on this very auspicious day, it's always a pleasure for me to get in front of anybody and talk about veterans. Veterans are my favorite people. I've been in a veteran-oriented program since I got out of the military. I'm currently serving as a state senior vice commander for the state of Indiana for the Veterans of Foreign Wars. We have 150 posts throughout the state, and we do a lot of traveling. I get to meet a lot of vets, and it's something I enjoy doing, so thank you. On the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, the armistice was signed. In 1926, Congress adopted a resolution directing the President to proclaim and observe Armistice Day. In 1954, President Eisenhower signed legislation changing the legal holiday from Armistice Day to the day to Veterans Day. In 1968, Congress proclaimed the fourth Monday as a new date to observe Veterans Day, but that didn't last very long. In 1975, Congress passed this legislation that returns Veterans Day observance back to November the 11th. I am so proud of all the veterans locally here. We have members from the Ranger Unit. If you hold your hands up, we have members from the Ranger Unit right here in Evansville that was the most decorated unit in Vietnam. Evansville has a pride and a very proud heritage of veterans. We have the second largest VFW post in the United States. And the reason for that is because of all the World War II vets that came back. There is such a mass of veterans, and I keep telling some of our elected politicians that veterans is where they need to go, because there is a lot of us here. And if we mass together, we can make change, and we need to remember that. I just want to tell you a little thing here. This you probably heard this poem before, but it's called It Is the Soldier. It is the soldier, not the minister, who has given us the freedom of religion. It is the soldier, not the reporter, who has given us the freedom of press. It is the soldier, not the poet, who has given us the freedom of speech. It is the soldier, not the campus organizer, who has given us the freedom to protest. It is the soldier, not the lawyer, who has given us the right to fair trial. It is the soldier, not the politician, who has given us the right to vote. It is the soldier who salutes the flag, who serves beneath the flag, and whose coffin is draped by the flag, who allows protesters to burn the flag. The next time you walk down the street and you see a gentleman or a female, there are a lot of female veterans, and do not forget that. That's a common mistake made these days. But there are a lot of veterans out there wearing a ball cap which says Vietnam, Afghanistan, whatever. When you see those people, walk up to them, shake their hand, and say, thank you very much for your service. If I had my way about it, Veterans Day would be every day. Again, Mark, thank you for letting me come in here and talk for a few minutes. And again, thank you very much, and enjoy your rest of the day.
I don't believe there much could be said after that. I believe it gives a pretty wide open story about how veterans and how we all are, and how really our families are affected. We come home and we try to put some normalcy back in your life, and you get married and you have your children, and life takes so many different turns and some are very painful, and yet some are so joyful. And to hear people talk about their families and what they mean to them is important, because to a veteran, his family is a veteran, and they understand how we feel and how they feel. So to all the ladies, thank you for serving with your husbands in their everyday life and needs and sorrows, because that's what makes America strong. At this time, I'd like to have the benediction by Russ Jones. Would you please come forward?
Shall we pray? God of compassion, God of dignity and strength, watch over the veterans of the United States. In recognition of their loyal service to our nation, bless them with a wholeness and love. Shelter them, heal their wounds, comfort their hearts, and grant them peace. God of justice and truth, rock our lives. Bless our veterans, these men and women of courage and valor, with a deep and abiding understanding of our profound gratitude. Protect them and their families from loneliness and want, and grant them lives of joy and bounty. And may their dedication and honor be remembered as a blessing from generation to generation. Blessed are you, protector and redeemer, our shield and our stronghold. Amen.
Amen.
This time I would ask the Retired Memorial Club to do the taps and echo, please. Present arms.
The somber sounds of a Veterans Day ceremony held this past Tuesday at Oak Hill Cemetery here in Evansville. Larry Acker emceed the event. He heads up the Vandenberg County Veterans Council. He also oversees the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Coliseum in downtown Evansville. Mayor Lloyd Winicky announced the winner of this year's Veteran of the Year, and we heard from him, Larry Lukeman. The keynote speaker was Army Sergeant Major Jerry Blake. Well, I'd like to thank my guests on this edition of The Trend, Matt Henke of USI, John Martin of the Evansville Courier and Press, and author, UE professor, and cartoonist James McLeod. Also a big thanks to Steve Berger for engineering today's broadcast. Also thanks to Samantha Horton for production support. You can always catch WNIN online at WNIN.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at WNIN News. I'm John Gibson. Thank you for joining us.
Support for this program is made possible in part by USI Outreach and Engagement, where USI is partnering with 23 counties along I-69, collaborating on economic development. More information at usi.edu/community.